Okay, we're underway. Now, lesson, session 22, lesson 4, page 36 of your outline. But I gave you some homework last week, didn't I? I asked you to look over the application. And I just wonder if anybody has put that application to work in their life. The application dealt with Yeshua's authority, his authority over our physical well-being, over sin, over mankind, humankind, over traditions, over the proper interpretation of Scripture, and in the area of spiritual warfare. Did anyone read through this and make any particular applications to their lives that they'd like to share? Again, no pressure. I'm not insisting on it, but if anyone has anything they'd like to share about the application, it would probably help others in the class. No pressure. Okay? All righty. Well, let's move on then and pick it up on section 63. We're at page 36 at the top. The 12 apostles named. 12 apostles named. We start... let's see, section 63 is on page 63 of your harmony. Mark and Luke cover this account, and we'll start with the Luke account. Luke chapter 6, verses 12 through 16. Luke 6, 12 through 16. We'll pick it up at Luke chapter 6, verse 12. Verse 12. Okay, everybody ready? Question. We'll talk quickly about it. All right, verse 12. And it was at this time that he went off to the mountain to pray, and he spent a whole night in prayer to God. All right, we from last week, we did see that multitudes were heading up to the Sea of Galilee to talk with Jesus and to find out what was going on up there. We saw that multitudes were coming out of Galilee. That would be Jewish people. But also, many people from Judea and Jerusalem were coming north up the Jordan River Valley to the Sea of Galilee. Also, Gentiles from Idumea crossing through the territory of Samaria up to Galilee. Then Gentiles from beyond the Jordan were mentioned, and finally Gentiles from Tyre and Sidon. So a lot of interest has been raised in the ministry of Jesus at this time. He's getting to be very popular. But now we learn that after a night of much prayer, you know, I haven't spent all night in prayer to God, you guys. I've never done that. So Jesus is way ahead of me on that. After a night of much prayer, much communion with his Father, he selects 12 men to be in his inner circle. And notice in verse 12 there, he consulted with God. He didn't consult with man regarding who he should choose. If he had consulted with man, this is what he would have come up with. Pick up your handout. Your handout says, "To Jesus, son of Joseph, woodcrafters, carpenter shot, Nazareth, 25922. Everybody there? You didn't get one? Okay. All right. Oops. No. Here, I've got some. I've got three here. Everybody?
Yeah, perfect.
Okay. All righty. All right. Now, everybody got the handout? If Jesus had gone to the Jordan Management Consultants, this is what he would have encountered. "Dear sir, thank you for submitting the resumes of the 12 men you have picked for managerial positions in your new organization. All of them have now taken our battery of tests, and we have not only run the results through our computer, but have also arranged personal interviews with each of them with our psychologist and vocational aptitude consultant. The profiles of all tests are included, and you want to study each one of them carefully. As part of our service, we make some general comments for your guidance, much as an auditor will include some general statements. This is given as a result of staff consultation and comes without any additional fee. Such a deal. Such a deal. It is the staff opinion that most of your nominees are lacking in background, education, and vocational aptitude for the type of enterprise you are undertaking. They do not have a team concept. We would recommend you continue your search for persons of experience in managerial ability and proven capability. Simon Peter is emotionally unstable and given to fits of temper. Andrew has absolutely no qualities of leadership. The two brothers, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, place personal interest above company loyalty. Thomas demonstrates a questioning attitude that would tend to undermine morale. He's a doubter, isn't he? We feel that it is our duty to tell you that Matthew has been blacklisted from the Greater Jerusalem Better Business Bureau. James, the son of Alphaeus, and Thaddeus definitely have radical leanings, and they both registered a high score on the manic depressive scale. One of the candidates, however, shows great potential. He is a man of ability and resourcefulness, meets people well, has a keen business mind, and has contacts in high places. He is highly motivated, ambitious, and responsible. We recommend Judas Iscariot as your controller and right-hand man. All of the other profiles are self-explanatory. We wish you every success in your new venture. Sincerely, yours. So man looks at things a little differently than God does. Right? Of course, right. All right, so out of this multitude of curious and would-be followers, Jesus selects 12. Now, why 12? I think to emphasize his authority over all 12 tribes. Not one or two tribes, but all of them. And he'll state this at least twice. Matthew 19:28. And Jesus said to them, "Truly I say to you, that you who have followed me, in the regeneration, when the Son of Man will sit on his glorious throne, you shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." And he repeats this idea in Luke 22:30. "You may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and you will sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel." So he has 12 in order to emphasize his authority over all of Israel. All right, let's pick it up at the 13th verse of Luke. The Luke account, verse 13, page 63 in your harmony. "And when day came, he called his disciples to him and chose 12 of them, whom he also named as apostles." Well, the disciples are the many. They are part of this very, very large group of followers. And the word disciple basically means learner. Someone who is learning with no implication of authority. The apostles, however, are the few. He chooses 12. And the word apostle there means sent one. The word means sent one, an ambassador, basically. One sent forth on a mission on behalf of another. That's the idea. So the title carries the authority of the sender, just like the United States government sends ambassadors to different countries. They go forth with the authority of the United States. Now, the reasons for appointing these men are brought out in the Mark account, verses 14 and 15. So move over to the left-hand column, verse 14. "And he appointed 12 that they might be with him, and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to cast out demons." So we have three reasons why he chose them. First of all, to be with him. They need to be with him in close contact with him to learn, to be trained for the ministry that they will take over when he leaves. So he wants to train these 12 very specifically and very closely. Secondly, he calls them in order to send them out to preach. They are going to proclaim the messianic kingdom that he's offering to Israel. That will be part of their ministry, proclaiming the messianic kingdom. And thirdly, to cast out demons. So they're sent out as apostles to authenticate the message that he is the Messiah and to relieve suffering, caused by demons. All right, now we're at the chart at the bottom of page 36. And that chart tells you some of the information we know about the 12 disciples, the 12 apostles. And you'll notice that column 1 is their name, but column 2 is their alternate name. And it's not unusual in the Jewish world to have an alternate name. Now, it's very common here in America. We have our English name and our Hebrew name. And that's the situation with me. My English name is Robert, or you call me Bob, or hey you, something like that. But my full name is Robert Elliot Morris. My middle name is Elliot. Elliot is an English form of the Hebrew word Elijah, Eliyahu. So if I went to Israel, I would go by my middle name, Eliyahu or Elijah. So that's very common. My brother, his name is Kenneth Saul Morris. So of course, Kenneth is his English name, Shaul Saul is his Hebrew name, his Jewish name. So if he made Aliyah, he would go by the name Saul or Shaul. All righty. Well, let's take a look at these disciples and learn a little bit more about them. The first one named there is Simon. That's his Hebrew name. Simon is actually known by three names. Cephas, that's Aramaic for Peter, and he's also known as Peter or Petros in the Greek. So he had a Hebrew, Aramaic, and Greek versions of his name. Now, we see that Simon and Andrew are brothers, the sons of John. Secondly is Andrew. That's a Greek name. It's a Greek name, but it is one that was used by the Jewish community. It appears in the Talmud, for example, as Andrei. And he was Simon Peter's brother. Then third, we have John. The Hebrew version of his name would be Yochanan. He is the disciple whom Jesus loved, more than likely, and he had an alternate name, Boanerges, the sons of thunder. Now, John and James are brothers, the sons of Zebedee. Their mother is Salome, or the Hebrew name is Shulamit. She's Mary's sister, and they are first cousins to Jesus. Point four, we come to James. The Hebrew version of his name would be Jacob or Yaakov, Jacob, James. Again, alternate name, son of thunder, a brother of John. The fifth name is Philip. That's a Greek name, but again, it's another Greek name that the Jewish people adopted. In the Talmud, it appears as Philippi or Philippi. And he was from Bethsaida, the home of Andrew and Peter. So he must have been a friend, perhaps a co-worker, something like that. A neighbor, who knows? Number six, Nathanael, Natanael, the gift of God. Natan, gift, ale, God, the gift of God. He has an alternate name. He's known as Bartholomew, which is Aramaic. Bartholomew actually means Bar-Talmai, or son of Talmai. So really, this is one long name. Nathanael, son of Talmai, would have been his complete name. Seventh, Thomas, that's Hebrew for twin. Didymus is Greek for twin. So these are Greek and Hebrew versions of the same name, and of course he has a twin somewhere. Identical twin, I don't know. I myself am a twin. My brother and I are fraternal twins. He doesn't look anything like me. He doesn't act anything like me. Okay, we are two very different people because we're fraternal twins. Matthew had the alternate name of Levi, a son of Alphaeus in Mark 2:14. Then number nine is James, also a son of Alphaeus, but apparently it's not the same Alphaeus as Matthew. Judas has an alternate name of Thaddeus, and James and Judas are brothers. So then comes number 11, Simon the Zealot, or he's also known as Simon the Canaanite, and Canaanite is simply, or I should say zealot, is simply a Grecianized form of the Hebrew Kanaim. Kanaim means zealot. So he's Simon the Zealot or Simon the Canaanite. And then finally, the very, very famous Judas Iscariot, His last name is made up of two words, Ish, which is Hebrew for man, and Kiriot, which is the name of a town in Judah. So his name is Judas, the man from the town of Kiriot. Judas Ish Kiriot. And it appears that he is the only disciple, only apostle from Judea, Kiriot being in Judea, all the rest being from Galilee. So that's some of the information we know about these 12 men. Top of page 37, under the title Extremes. I want to point out the extremes in men that can be brought together in the Messiah. And these extremes are seen in Matthew the publican and Simon the zealot. Well, we already know about the publicans, right? Romanizers. They cooperated with Rome collecting taxes. They stole, extorted money out of their Jewish brothers and sisters, hated by the Jewish community as Romanizers. Well, what about zealots? Okay, let's just work through the sentences on page 37. Zealot is a Greek term. They called themselves by the Hebrew term Kanaim. And again, both Greek and Hebrew terms mean zealot. Now, the words denote religious jealousy and zeal for the exclusive honor of Israel's God against anyone or anything that threatened to diminish his honor. And the spiritual heritage of the zealots goes all the way back to Numbers 25, verses 1 through 8, and Phinehas. Now, in that account, Israel was playing the harlot with the Midianite women, running wild with the Midianite women. And Phinehas was so zealous for the Lord that he slew his brother Jew, that he killed those who were consorting immorally with the Midianite women. That takes zeal. Elijah fell into this zealous tradition, and he manifested comparable zeal to God. Elijah and the prophets of Baal, right? Had a very dramatic encounter with them. The Maccabees, also in 164 BC, went against the Greeks. So there was a well-established tradition of religious zeal in Israel. Therefore, when the Zealots emerged as a distinct party in 6 AD, the Zealot spirit was not something new. However, because Rome ruled, Zealot action took on the definite flavor of a patriotic resistance. Now, open insurrection against the provincial authority of Rome was out of the question. So they used guerrilla tactics. Guerrilla tactics have been around a long time. For example, they mingled in the crowds in Jerusalem during the festivals when everybody was had made their pilgrimage to Jerusalem. They would sidle up to the objects of their displeasure with daggers concealed in their clothes and stab them, and then melt away into the surrounding crowd. Now, under every form of torture, no zealot, young or old, who was captured could be compelled to acknowledge Caesar as Lord. They were fiercely anti-Roman. They displayed boundless ferocity in the warfare against Rome and Romanizers. And some scholars come up with an interesting thought here. Some scholars think that they had a battle cry, "Take up your cross." This has not been particularly confirmed. So if it is true, it is a cry of total commitment to the cause, because they knew if they were captured, what was their destiny? They would be crucified. And Dr. Edersheim, one more sentence on the top of page 38. They were almost as hostile to the Jewish establishment, the wealthy aristocracy of the day. And then Dr. Edersheim sums it up. Their hearts burned within them for their God, for their land, for their people, their religion, and their freedom. So with all that in mind, we have a zealot and a publican getting together. A zealot with a local tax gatherer for Rome. A zealot with a Romanizer. A man who was considered a traitor, an apostate, defiled by frequent association with the heathen, a willing tool of the oppressor. I wonder what it was like when Jesus brought these two guys together and said, Matthew, I'd like you to meet Simon the Zealot here. Simon would have said, who? This guy? Oh yeah, why don't you sit down next to him? What? It must have been quite an interesting first meeting. But this is the extremes that Jesus can bring together. This is the extremes, how Jesus can change people's hearts. All right, I have an article about the zealots on page 38 for you, another article on the publicans on page 39 for you. So let's pick it up at the chart on the bottom of page 39. And we can learn something about these disciples, these apostles, from this chart. Now the chart has four columns. That's because there are four different lists of disciples in the Bible. And I've put the columns side by side so you can compare their differences. But I want you to point some things out to you. First of all, row number one in bold, Simon Peter is the same name all the way across in every list. And then rows 2, 3, and 4 are mixed. The names are not the same all the way across. Row number 5, Philip. His name is the same across, but then rows 6, 7, and 8 are mixed. The names are not in the same order. Then number 9, row 9, James the son of Alphaeus, same name all the way across. Rows 10, 11, and 12 are mixed. Now what's the point? Well, the point deals with the way names were tabulated in those days. Basically, what this chart tells us is that Jesus organized the apostles into three groups of four disciples each, and each group had the leader. Each group had a leader. Group number one, Simon Peter was the leader. James, Andrew, and John were in his group, and all four were formerly John the Baptist's disciples. Second group, headed up by Philip, and under him, Bartholomew, Matthew, and Thomas. And finally, the third group, headed up by James, son of Alphaeus, and under him, Thaddeus, Simon, and Judas Iscariot. So apparently, the Messiah had thoroughly organized his disciples in a very orderly way. And I do want to make a comment here that I run into people that feel that organization and order are not very spiritual. You've just got to let the Spirit lead. Just go with the flow. Let it happen. You know, that way you're more spiritual. Well, I don't agree with that, because our God is a God of decency and good order. God of good order. And we see that order right here in his ministry as he prepares them for ministry. So order and organization are very compatible with service to the Lord. The church has its order as well. It's organized under elders and deacons, for example. All righty, let's move on to the next page, page 40, section 64. And here we come to the famous Sermon on the Mount. And if I could, I would put a plastic shield up in front of me here, because some of you are going to want to throw tomatoes at me as I start through this background material. Because I will not be looking at this sermon in exactly the same way most pastors and most churches deal with the sermon. So some of you might be upset with me as we go through it. Hang in there with me, okay? Hang in there with me. You're going to leave now?
Are you zealous?
I'm zealous, yes.
All martyrs are zealous.
All martyrs are zealous.
But not all zealots are martyrs.
All righty. Let's start then with a definition at the top. What is the definition of the Sermon on the Mount that I'll be using here? The Sermon on the Mount is the Messiah's authority to interpret the law of Moses. The Messiah's authority to interpret the law of Moses. What is the relevance of the Sermon on the Mount? Here, the Messiah pronounces the proper interpretation of the Mosaic law, the Torah, in contrast to the Pharisees' interpretation. All right, let's prepare for some background here and read a couple of verses that describe the background of the sermon. So we're at section 64, which is the bottom of page 63 in your harmony. Matthew and Luke both cover the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew is the left-hand column. So let's read verses 1 and 2 at the bottom of page 63, left-hand column. And when he saw the multitudes, he went up on the mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him, and opening his mouth, he began to teach them, saying. All right, before we get into what he actually said, we need to develop some very, very important background material. So let's take a look at the four points I have there. Number one, first thing we should recall, there is intense interest in Jesus at this point because Israel expected the Messiah to come and set up his kingdom and overthrow Rome. So the Messiah would come and offer the kingdom. Secondly, the message of the Old Testament prophets was this: righteousness is the way to enter the kingdom. Point three, Jesus is preaching a righteousness of God, and he's offering the kingdom to Israel. He's doing exactly what Israel expected to happen. And his message is absolutely biblical: the kingdom and righteousness. And notice also, never forget, he's already encountered opposition from the Pharisees, because the Pharisees claimed to offer righteousness, but they offered it through the Mishnah as the way of entering the kingdom. They offered it through the Mishnah, the oral law. So we have a key issue here. Is Pharisaic righteousness sufficient to enter the kingdom? If it is not, what kind of righteousness is necessary? And will Jesus support or repudiate Pharisaic righteousness? Well, I'm going to jump ahead and spoil all the fun by giving you the answer to that question. The answer to that question comes in section 67. So turn over to page 65 in your harmony. And section 67 is at the top of page 65, and we want to look at verse 20. Top of the page, section 67, verse 20. Jesus says, "For I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you shall not enter the kingdom of heaven." So the answer, Jesus will repudiate Pharisaic righteousness. He will repudiate Pharisaic interpretation of the Torah contained in the Mishnah. He will say that Pharisaic righteousness is not sufficient righteousness to enter the kingdom, and that the Pharisees do not interpret the law properly. Okay? Now, what is the Sermon on the Mount as a unit? As a unit. In context. I'm going to be moving through the Sermon on the Mount as a unit and trying to keep everything in context. It is very rarely handled that way. Usually one beatitude is ripped out of context and a 30-minute sermon is preached around one beatitude or something like that. We want to look at the whole thing and keep the whole sermon in context. It is a magnificent sermon, but it needs to be viewed properly, I believe. So, what is the Sermon on the Mount? Let's start with what it is not. Bottom of page 40. 3 points. It is not the constitution of the Messianic kingdom, of the kingdom. These are not laws of the Messianic kingdom per se. You see, the Sermon on the Mount requires you to keep all 613 Mosaic laws. We'll see that very soon. And yet we know that the law in the kingdom period differs from the Mosaic law. Those of you that went through Ezekiel with me, chapters 40 through 48, took a look at Messianic kingdom law. And that's one of the reasons the rabbis had trouble with Ezekiel, because the Messianic kingdom law and the Mosaic law do not match. So the law in the kingdom is different from the Mosaic law, so this is not the constitution of the kingdom. Secondly, The Sermon on the Mount is not a means of salvation. If it was, salvation would be of works and not of faith. And many people, you'll hear them say this, "Oh, I'm a Christian, I follow the Sermon on the Mount." But following the Sermon on the Mount is not the basis for salvation, is it? It's grace through faith. That's the basis of salvation. So there's many people that are confused on that issue. Now here's where the tomatoes are going to fly. Stick with me, you guys, okay? Stick with me. The Sermon on the Mount is not ethics for this age. We're on page 41 at the top of the page. It is not ethics for this age. If it is, you have to enforce the Mosaic Law, the Torah, because we will see contained in this sermon is the requirement that the Mosaic Law be kept to every jot and tittle. Every detail is demanded in this sermon when it's viewed in context as a unit. For example, some of the requirements of the Mosaic Law. Keeping kosher, the dietary laws. You have to carefully discipline your diet. If you don't, you've not only violated the Mosaic Law, but the Sermon on the Mount. What about clothing, the clothes you wear? Leviticus 19:19 states that a Jewish person is not to wear clothes woven out of two types of thread. Most of the clothes we wear are a combination of threads, right? Well, the type of clothes we wear violates the Sermon on the Mount and the Mosaic Law if we have to enforce the Sermon on the Mount and the Mosaic Law. What about money? Oh, this is where people are surprised. What about tithing? Tithing under the Mosaic system consisted of three P's. Number one, the priest's tithe. Each year you were to pay 10% of your income to the Levites so they could teach you the word. So if you want to follow that today, you need to find a Levite to teach you the word of God and pay him 10% of your yearly wage to support him. Secondly, the second P of the Mosaic tithing system, the pilgrim tithe. You were supposed to set aside 10% of your yearly income so that you could travel to the three pilgrim festivals: Passover, Pentecost, Tabernacles. Passover, Shavuot, Sukkot. You had to set aside a savings account so you could make the journey to Jerusalem three times a year. Not a bad idea. I think everybody should set aside enough money to go to Israel three times a year. Good idea. So there you go. Go ahead and do it. All right, thirdly, the poor tithe. Each Jewish family was to set aside 3% each year for the poor. That was a social welfare system. So the yearly tithing under the Mosaic system is 23% a year, not 10%. You think any pastor is going to get up there on his a pulpit and tell you you're required to give 23% a year to the church? Well, that's the tithe under the Old Testament, 23% a year. And a big thing in the Messianic movement is attending Shabbat services and in the Rabbinic Judaism of today. This is not mentioned in the Mosaic Law. Instead, the Mosaic Law says in Leviticus 23:3, you are to stay in your homes and rest. That's what the word Shabbat means. It's a day of rest, not a day of worship. And if you break any of these laws, you're under the curses of the covenant. And remember, the Sermon on the Mount requires you to follow all these. But most significantly, if you are required to follow the Sermon on required to follow the Mosaic Law, Yeshua, Jesus, cannot be your high priest. Jesus operates under the order of Melchizedek. The order under the Mosaic Law is the Aaronic order, the order of Aaron. And Jesus cannot be your high priest if you have to follow the Mosaic Law, if that's what the Sermon on the Mount teaches. All right, I can see all the tomatoes in everybody's hands, but let's cover what is the Sermon on the Mount. Well, for that, you'll have to come back after the break. All right, so take your break, listen for the shofar. All right, let's resume our study of the Sermon on the Mount. All right, we've learned what the Sermon on the Mount is not. Now we want to look at what the Sermon of the Mount is. And this is on page 41, middle of page 41. All right, Bob, what is this sermon? Basically, the Sermon on the Mount is the Messiah's interpretation of the righteousness that the law demands. Now, he's going to make a big contrast in this sermon. The contrast is going to be between him and the Pharisees, because the Pharisees emphasized external conformity. They emphasized the external. But Jesus emphasizes internal conformity to God's righteousness that expresses itself externally. And there's a big difference there, because external practice does not change the inner man. You know, I can put on all kinds of religious garb, but that's not going to change who I am inside. But in contrast, when the inner man changes, then the external behavior changes as well. All right, so that's his interpretation of the righteousness that the law demands. The purpose, then, is to convict men of their unrighteousness as they see the righteousness of God. In other words, he wants his audience to understand that they have fallen short the glory of God, that they have sinned and fallen short the glory of God. Now, next page. Now, I am not trying to rip the Sermon on the Mount away from you. I got this far many years ago, and some lady said, "Bob, you're destroying the Sermon on the Mount for me." Well, no, I'm not going to do that. And I'm going to tell you why here, okay? Because I want to go through some background material on how to interpret and apply the Sermon on the Mount. Now, the basis, of course, lies in verses like 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17, and this is on page 42. 2 Timothy 3:16 and 17 says, "All Scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work." So no matter whether a Scripture is in the Old Testament or the New Testament, especially the Old Testament, it is profitable. It is profitable to us. Another verse, also on page 42, Romans 15:4. "For whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction." So that which was written in earlier dispensations is useful to us, can instruct us, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. We're missing out on hope if we ignore that which was written in earlier times. You know, we're missing out on a measure of hope that the Scripture can provide for us. All right. So that which is written for earlier times is useful to us. All right. Now, what about interpretation? We're on page 43. Context is critical. Have I emphasized that enough? Context is king. Do not rip pieces of the sermon out of context. That's what happens all the time. Many times, the whole sermon is not taught as a unit. But context is important. So what is the context of the sermon? 5 points. Number one, this is a mark it up moment. Note point one. Highlight it. Star it. I don't care what you do. Jesus is a Jew living under the Mosaic covenant and living it out perfectly. He's fulfilling it. He's submitting to the law fully. He's living under the dispensation of the Mosaic law. Or perhaps we could call it earlier times. He's living under what was written in earlier times. Two, the new covenant has not yet been inaugurated. This is what commentators and pastors seem to ignore or forget. The new covenant will not be inaugurated for another year or year and a half at Passover AD 30. We're just not there yet. So the Mosaic covenant will end and the new covenant will begin with the death of the Messiah. Now the dispensation we live under has not yet begun. The church age has not yet begun. Let me emphasize that over and over. Thirdly, the audience are Jewish people living under the Torah, living under the Mosaic covenant and its stipulations. Fourthly, remember that the new covenant and the Mosaic covenant are two different covenants, and you must not mix them together or chaos and confusion results. So fifthly, recognize what is occurring here in this sermon as a unit. Yeshua is contrasting the Mishnaic interpretation of the Torah with God's interpretation of the Torah. In the Mishnah, the basic message goes like so. The Pharisees say that the Torah says this. In the Gospels, the message, basic message goes like this. Yeshua speaking, God says the Torah says this. So it's what the Pharisees say and what God says. That's what's going on here. All right, point B. Or it doesn't have a B in your outline. The application. Now the Sermon on the Mount confronts us with two aspects, attitudes and actions. So let's start with the aspect of our attitudes. The attitudes are the internal aspect of the Sermon on the Mount. So we're in the middle of page 43. Now the Sermon on the Mount gives us a look into the heart of God and the attitudes he desires from his righteous ones. Now righteousness means to live by a standard of behavior. Now the standard of behavior was the Mosaic covenant, the Mosaic law, until the Mosaic law came to a close. Then the standard of behavior became the stipulations of the New Covenant, the New Testament that we have today. And we live under the New Covenant today. We live under its commands. Did you know there are over 600 commands in your New Testament? Well, over 600 commands. You don't see them in the English, but you see them very clearly in the Greek because the Greek has an imperative form. And they just pop out at you all over. There's over 600 commands in the New Testament. We live under the law of the Messiah today, not under the Mosaic law. And those are commands, guys. Those are not options. You know, so assume, whenever you read the epistles, for example, you read something, love your brother, assume it's a command. Because 99.9% of the time, it is a command. Flee immorality, it's a command. Don't go to a lawsuit in public courts against your brother. That's a command. Okay? So view it in that sense. All right. Now the attitude that God desires from his righteous ones are the same under either covenant. And so the attitudes expressed in the Sermon on the Mount can easily be transferred and applied to our lives today. That's the overlap between these two covenants. We can apply the attitudes to our day. All right, let's go to page 44. And I give you an example. The situation is kind of like traffic laws. You know, when I was finishing up my Army career, a great long career of 3 years, I finished it up in Virginia. And I use that as an example. The laws of California and the laws of Virginia are two different law codes, right? We don't go by Virginia law code here in California, do we? Okay? We keep the two codes separate. We drive by California law in California and Virginia law in Virginia. However, the principles or the attitudes that inspired the two codes are the same. Both states, California and Virginia, wanted safe, controlled roads, safe, controlled intersections, etc. But they enacted different laws to reach that goal. For example, in California, free rights are allowed. When we were in Virginia, we had just driven there from Seattle, and we said to ourselves, Susan and myself, can we make free rights here? And I said, well, you better check with the police. So Susan went down to the police station and said, can we do free rights here? The guy didn't know what she was talking about. He said, honey, that's reckless driving. Here, that's reckless driving. Okay? $100 fine in the 70s, you know? Here, you guys can do U-turns. Up in Portland and Seattle, you can't do U-turns. When I first got down here, you guys blew me away doing all these U-turns in front of me. What's going on with these people? Well, now I do them all the time, of course. See, I'm thinking Northwest law rather than California law, okay? But the attitudes are the same under both codes. We want safe, controlled roads, intersections, etc. But the actions, the behaviors are different. In California, we make free rights and U-turns. In Virginia, you do not. But you see say again? Free rights?
Yeah, why do they call it that?
Because you... Well, you guys call it... Well, we call it a free ride in Seattle. That's what it's called to me. Come up to a red light, stop, then you're free to make a right-hand turn. Okay? That's the way I understand it. Maybe that's my Northwest culture, huh?
What do they call it? A California stop here?
A California stop here is to slow down and go through the... slow down for the stop line and... That's a California stop. And believe me, that's what we called it, yeah. That's what it is. All right. All right, so the attitudes are the same and readily transfer from code to code, but the behavior doesn't necessarily transfer. Now, the Sermon on the Mount. When reading the Sermon on the Mount, look for the attitudes that God wants to be characteristic of his righteous ones and apply them to your life. You know, meek, peacemakers, etc., things like that. Look for the attitudes, okay? Because those attitudes will be identical under both covenants. All right, page 45 at the top. Now let's deal with that area of actions. Actions are the external expressions of what's going on inside. Now, actions will vary under different covenants. Remember, the content of behavior for a person living under the Mosaic Covenant is different than a person living under the New Covenant. And remember some of the examples I gave you of Mosaic Covenant behavior. The food laws, the clothing laws, the giving laws, Shabbat, things like that. When the Mosaic Covenant was discontinued, the behavior requirements changed. Now, some of them were transferred to the New Covenant. For example, don't be sexually immoral. Why do we follow that command? Because it's stated in the New Testament. Not because it's stated in the Mosaic Covenant, but because it's stated in the New Testament. Question?
Did Christ do this? Did Jesus do this if he was under the Mosaic law?
Did he do what?
All these food laws,
yes.
Laws,
he submitted to the Mosaic law. He fulfilled it perfectly. So, he obeyed every law that was applicable to him.
Wow.
Perfectly.
A lot of kosher Jewish delis,
yes. Say again? Like the clothing
law?
Sure, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. He fulfilled the Mosaic law. He was the only Jew that ever did. He obeyed every law that applied to him.
That's
perfectly. Yeah, it is. We can't do that. Yeah. All righty. So some of these behaviors are transferred to the New Covenant, and we follow them because they are commanded in the New Covenant. Some behaviors are discontinued. For example, wearing clothes woven of two types of thread is not a command in the New Testament. And again, remember those traffic laws. When we move from California to Virginia, our driving practices changed. Some stayed the same, some changed. We still stop for red lights in Virginia, right? Yeah, everywhere there's red lights. That's common everywhere. Because you want safe, controlled intersections. But you stop making free rights and you stop making U-turns when you get to Virginia. Okay? All right. Your external behavior can change because the law code changes. Okay, conclusion. Page 46. When you're reading the Sermon on the Mount, number one, readily transfer attitudinal and character principles, because God wants all believers at all times under all covenants to exhibit these characteristics. For example, meekness, mercy, peacemaker, etc. That's always true. Secondly, carefully analyze behavior principles in light of the new covenant revelation. Some should not be practiced. For example, sacrifices for sin, because Yeshua is our sacrifice under the new covenant. He is our sacrifice for sin. So it would be totally inappropriate to go to the third temple when it gets set up and offer a Yom Kippur sacrifice or anything like that. Totally inappropriate. He is our sacrifice for sin. All right, so some should not be practiced. Some can be voluntarily practiced. For example, dietary laws. If you want to eat biblically kosher, you're free to do so. Just don't impose it upon your brother. You're free to do so. The principle is freedom. We have freedom to choose some principles to adopt. So some behaviors of the Mosaic Law should not be practiced. Some can be voluntarily practiced. Others are fully obligatory under the New Covenant. But they're obligatory because they're found under the New Testament. And that's what we obey. And by the way, it's a big deal in Rabbinic Judaism today. You've seen this, and it's a big deal in the Messianic movement today to observe the Sabbath, observe Shabbat. Well, the obligation to observe the Sabbath was not transferred to the New Covenant. Sabbath observance is voluntary under the New Testament. You know, if you want to take a day off, do it. It's a great idea. You don't have to. In fact, it's a good idea in this rush, 21st century Orange County world we live in. But if you want to keep rushing around on Saturday, go right ahead. But if you want to rest, that's perfectly fine too. That's what the word Shabbat means. It's a day of rest. It never was a day of worship. It's a day of rest. And you're supposed to rest in your own dwellings. So it's voluntary today.
Isn't that a six-day work week, though, and they rested on?
Yeah, six-day work week, and they rested on one day a week.
We usually have a
5-day. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can rest 2 days if we want to. If we want to. All right. Now, just to emphasize this, Colossians 2, 16 and 17, talking about voluntary observance of principles in the Mosaic Law. Paul says, therefore, no one is to act as your judge in regard to food or drink, that's the kosher laws, the food requirements, or in respect to a festival, that's like observing Passover, or a new moon, or, and he singles out, a Sabbath day. And he probably singles it out because it was such a big deal in Rabbinic Judaism. Things which are a mere shadow of what is to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. So no one is to act as your judge. You can eat kosher if you want to. You can observe the Sabbath if you want to. Don't judge your brother who doesn't. And don't judge your brother who does. This is voluntary. Romans 14, 5 and 6, another principle that's very important. One person regards one day above another. Another person regards every day alike. Each person must be fully convinced in his own mind. That's the principle. Let your brother or sister make their own decision and be fully convinced of it. And give them the grace to do that. He who observes the day observes it for the Lord, and he who eats does so for the Lord, for he gives thanks to God. And he who eats not, for the Lord he does not eat, and give thanks to God. Okay? So we're not to judge our brothers in some of these voluntary behaviors. And finally, Galatians 3:19 points out that the Mosaic Law has been discontinued. It's not obligatory. Paul says, why the law then? He answers that question. It was added. The word added there tells us that the Mosaic Law had a beginning. It began in 1446 BC at Mount Sinai. But then he goes on. It was added because of transgressions, having been ordained through angels by the agency of a mediator until. And the word until tells us the Mosaic law had an end. And the end is described until the seed would come to whom the promise had been made, until the Messiah came. And the Messiah, Jesus, instituted the new covenant at Passover 30 AD and brought the Mosaic law as a legal requirement to an end. So Shabbat observance is voluntary. And by the way, it was a sign of the Mosaic covenant. And so when the Mosaic covenant became inoperative, the symbol likewise became inoperative.
I have a
question.
What day do you consider
Shabbat? Say again?
What day do you consider Shabbat?
Shabbat is always Saturday, always the seventh day of the week. Yes. Friday evening. Yes, the Jewish day starts in the evening. Right. Starts Friday evening, goes through Saturday evening. Correct. That doesn't mean you can't take a day off on a different day.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
You know, the principle there is rest. Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. It was meant to benefit us. So if you want, so take a day off, you guys. I don't care if you take it off Wednesday. Take it off. Don't go rushing through life and giving yourself, a heart attack. What was that?
As long as it's not Tuesday.
As long as it's not Tuesday. That's right. I like that. You get an A, Leslie. Yeah, you're okay. Come on Tuesday night. Yeah.
According to that, we have the Beatitudes and the Do Attitudes.
The Do Attitudes and the Beatitudes. Right, there you go. All righty. Now, let me share an outline of the Sermon on the Mount that is very Jewish in its approach. Now, Judaism is considered to be based on three pillars. Now, the Torah, worship, and acts of loving kindness. And this goes back to the Mishnah Avot 1-2. By three things is the world sustained: by Torah, that's the Bible, by Avodah, that's worship, and by deeds of loving kindness. And a scholar named W.D. Davis takes the position that the topical order of the Sermon on the Mount follows this order of the Torah, the Avodah, and the acts of loving kindness. And so he divides up the Sermon on the Mount into three sections: Matthew 5, 17 through 48 as Torah or Bible, Matthew 6, 1 through 16 as focusing on Avodah, worship, and Matthew 6, 19 through 7, 12 dealing with acts of loving kindness. So that's an interesting breakdown. I haven't really decided whether I'm ever going to follow that or not, but it's a very logical and appealing way to approach the Sermon on the Mount, because Jesus is talking to the Jewish community here. He's talking to Jewish people in the first century. All right, page 47, top of the page. The occasion for the sermon. Again, after the 12 have been selected, after intense interest from the masses, and that intense interest is emphasized in the Luke account. Luke chapter 6, verses 17 through 19. So this is back on page 63 of your harmony, verses 17 through 19, right-hand column. And he descended with them and stood on a level place, and there was a great multitude of his disciples, and a great throng of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon, who had come to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were being cured. And all the multitude was trying to touch him, for power was coming from him and healing them all. So Luke mentions the intense interest in Yeshua, but he doesn't mention everybody that the previous section mentioned. He notes that they're by the Sea of Galilee. He talks about the disciples. Those would be the people coming to the Sea of Galilee from Galilee. He mentions those coming from Judea and Jerusalem up the Jordan Valley. And he mentions those coming from Tyre and Sidon, Gentiles coming to Jesus. So he has a little more abbreviated account of the crowds that were coming to Jesus. So we've got the 12 selected. We've got intense interest from the masses. Point three, This comes after the initial conflict with the Mishnah, so we've already begun our conflict over Pharisaic tradition, and Jesus, which we saw earlier. And the location is a level place on a mountain not far from Capernaum. And the section state that Jesus went up and down and up and down. So apparently the sequence of events is this, that he went up on into the hill to pray, Luke 6:12. He spent the night in prayer. Then he called the 12 disciples to become apostles. Then he went down with them to a level place to talk to the people and to hear diseases and to heal diseases. And then he went up higher, and the multitudes followed, and then he delivered the Sermon on the Mount. So however it all happened, here is the traditional location of the Sermon on the Mount. This is a view taken by Israel Ministry of Tourism from the Sea of Galilee. And you can see in the middle of the picture up near the top there, the church that marks the traditional location of the Sermon on the Mount. It is a level place up the mountain or up the hill. In Israel, the mountains, we would call them hills. And down in the foreground, you can see the banana plantation that's been planted there. It's a very active banana plantation these days. Here is another view looking up the hill toward the traditional location of the Sermon on the Mount. Here is an aerial view. And off on the right, you can see the slope going down to the Sea of Galilee, and the Sea of Galilee in the upper right-hand corner. And there's an overview of that church in the traditional location. Now, I took this picture to show you the grounds, the beautiful grounds there. It's well kept. It's a very popular tourist spot. And it's a possible location for the Sermon on the Mount, a kind of a level spot. Notice the hill continues upward. As you go up a number of steps, the terrain continues upward from that level spot where the church is located. So it is a possible location. And here's a close-up of that church and another view of it from another direction. So it's a very nice place, especially on a nice sunny day with the breeze coming off the Sea of Galilee and time to spend there. Now, one more thing. We learned that this is near Capernaum. This location is near Capernaum. And you see in this picture a gateway. This gateway is the gateway to the driveway off the main road going down to the ruins of Capernaum. The bus or the cars turn off the main road onto this driveway. And they go a couple hundred yards down to the parking lot, and then you have to walk another 100 yards or so to Capernaum itself. But if you turn around and look at the entrance to where you just came in, you see a hill. And what's at the top of the hill? The traditional location of the Sermon on the Mount. And I share this picture with you because it emphasizes how small Israel is. Everything is very close together. It's very easy to walk from one location to another. So you can walk from Capernaum up the mount to get to that traditional location, and it fits very well into what we have in Scripture. All righty, well, we are out of time, so that brings us to section 65. So we'll start up next week with the actual text of the Sermon on the Mount, and we'll look at the... Wait a second, you guys. I'm going to cover one more thing, one more point with you. Section 65. The blessings of those who inherit the kingdom and the woes to those who do not. Now, this section is going to reflect the blessing and cursing aspect of the Mosaic covenant. And we're going to see that very, very clearly here. The blessings and cursings of the Mosaic Covenant are found in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. So let's take a quick review of that. You'll get these slides. The morning class asked for them, so you'll get them. The blessings and cursings of the Mosaic Covenant. The Sermon on the Mount will follow this pattern because it is Yeshua's interpretation of the Mosaic Law. All right, first of all, Leviticus 26. We'll just deal with that chapter. The chapter begins with the blessings. In verses 1 and 2, obedience is required. That is very clearly stated. This is a conditional covenant. Obedience is required. It's mandatory. In verses 3 and 4, the conditional nature of blessing is brought out. If you obey, I will bless you. And then the blessings begin in verses 5 through 8. If you obey, you will experience prosperity, security, and peace. In verses 9 through 13, probably the greatest blessing is brought out. God's presence. I will walk among you if you obey me. But then the cursing aspect of the covenant comes into view, starting in verse 14. But if you do not obey me, I will afflict you with sickness, harassment, and insecurity to get your attention. If you still don't obey me, you will experience drought and famine. Israel, living in disobedience today, has been under drought conditions for the last decade. Coincidence? I don't think so. If you still choose to disobey me, I will send wild animals among you. And all these curses were experienced before and during the Assyrian invasions. In verses 23 through 26, if you still don't obey me, you'd think we'd have the message by now, you will experience the horrors of siege. And this was experienced during the Assyrian and Babylonian invasions. In verses 27 through 33, if you still choose to disobey me, you will experience devastation, deportation, dispersion, and cannibalism. You will eat your children. I think that would straighten me up, but it didn't. And this was experienced during the Babylonian and Roman destructions. The Babylonian, both of those curses came upon us during that time. In verses 34 and 35, the state of the land during deportation is described, resting and desolate. This was experienced after the Babylonian and Roman destructions, for 70 years after the Babylonian exile, and for 2,000 years after the Roman destruction. In verses 36 through 39, the state of the people during deportation is described. We are described as being fearful, weak, dispersed, and persecuted. Perfect description of the Jewish experience for the past 2,000 years. This was experienced after the Roman destruction. But God does not leave us without hope. In verses 40 through 46, he says, after all of this, I am still going to restore you, and I will restore you from a worldwide dispersion. And that is exactly what we are experiencing in the modern state of Israel today. All right, so we'll pick it up next week with the actual text of the Sermon on the Mount, and I want you to be looking for these aspects. So let me pray.
Can we get a copy of that?
Yes, you will get a copy of these slides.
I just wanted to say that so that you can tell the morning class and the evening class after.
Okay, let me pray, you guys. Let me pray. Father, again, I just want to stop and thank you for your word. And Lord, I want to emphasize the character aspects of the Sermon on the Mount, the character aspects that are brought out throughout your word, from Genesis to Revelation. You want your righteous ones to have a character and to live with attitudes that are pleasing to you. And we're grateful that you work in our lives to create those attitudes and characteristics and character in our souls. So Lord, help us to embrace that change as you bring it about in our lives, and help us to embrace it as we go through the Sermon on the Mount starting next week. And I ask this in Yeshua's name. Amen. All righty, we'll see you guys next week.